take that threat out?
If we have to. But I think there's another way to handle it. I don't think she's lost. Not all the way. Not yet.
Alice, Evangeline said, picking up on an image of her in his mind. He nodded.
Wiley and I know how important she is to you and Hugo. That's why we had to meet with the family.
He placed his hand on her knee.
They've given us permission to try to defuse the situation before taking more drastic measures.
What does Natalie think about you and your more drastic measures? She considered removing his hand from her knee, but it proved unnecessary. He released her and rose to his feet.
Natalie doesn't know anything about this.
Then why was she invited to the big Boudreaux confab? Lincoln's forehead scrunched up, his jaw jutting forward.
She wasn't invited. She wasn't there.
He wasn't lying. He was confused by Evangeline's belief Natalie had been with them. Maybe Natalie had gone to try to intervene on Alice's behalf. Maybe Natalie was banging someone else. Either way, Evangeline had bigger questions.
Could you do it?
She gripped the chair's arms. Could you kill Alice?
You have to understand.
Could you do it? Evangeline screamed at him. He bolted back, his eyes opening wide. Sugar ran into the room, positioning herself between them, staring up at Lincoln and chirping.
Yes,
he said, his voice coming out low.
If I have to. If that's what it takes to protect others.
Evangeline nodded slowly, focusing on the floor between Lincoln and the cat. What if you're wrong? What if this danger you're trying to quell isn't Alice? She looked up, her eyes fixing on his. She recognized a glint of fear dawning in them. What if it's me? Could you do it then? His face flushed. Fear was stoking anger.
But it isn't.
Could you do it then? She said, nearly growling out the words. She needed an answer. She had to know. He blinked and fell silent. His inner debate lasted a full minute. Then he spoke.
No,
he said, his voice firm, sure and honest.
I could not.
Evangeline closed her eyes, digging her nails into the arms of the chair. Then you need to go, she said, her voice coming out in a near whisper. She opened her eyes and glared at him. I said you need to go. His shoulders fell. His jaw dropped open. He was hurt, shocked.
Evangeline, he said,
his voice pleading. She jumped up from the chair and advanced on him, getting right up into his face. You need to go, and you need to find someone who can. 'Cause I don't think it's Alice, I think it's me. A knock sounded on the door. Lincoln turned, making a move toward the door, but Evangeline's hand shot out and caught hold of him. Wait, she said. I'll get it. She knew who was knocking. She also knew that if Lincoln answered the knock, it would mean his death. If you love me, she said, if you really love me, you will find a way to stop me. She sent a pulse of energy through her hand into him. He slumped and fell to the floor. Sugar scooted away from his falling form, looking up at her. The cat shot another cascade of images at her, demanding explanations, trying to convince her to ignore the knock and stay home where it was safe. A second, more insistent rap on the door shattered her pet's desperate attempt to hold on to her. Mama's sorry, baby. Evangeline crossed to the door and opened it. Her father, her true father, stood on her doorstep, holding out his hand to her. Evangeline didn't want to take it, but her hand no longer seemed in her control. As if by magnetism, it reached out to take his. Then, like an electric fence latching on to the careless hand that grasped it, she was caught. He tugged her over the threshold and down to the street. 33. The blood of Uranus gleams eternally on the blade held to Cronus's thigh. They circled each other, Astrid and her eldest son taking the other's measure. He was magnificent. His hate for her was so perfect, so complete.
"My son," she said. "My masterpiece."
Tonight, the beast would rise and claim his crown as the king of bones and ashes, the greatest and perhaps the last. Never before had magic known a queen of heaven born of the dark man's seed. This queen could reign forever, and should she do so, it would be with Astrid's son at her side. Luke laid hands on her and maneuvered her to the center of the clearing. He presented her to the cold fire, and the dark man agreed to accept Astrid as the first sacrifice. This was an honor beyond anything she could have wished. It came to her as an odd revelation that although Luke loathed her, his dark heart harbored an affection for Babu Jean. Though Astrid had promised the creature to remain forever with him, she would go alone into the fire. The vow she had made was of no import, as Babu Jean no longer desired her company. He'd been trying to throw her ever since the Book of the Unwinding unfurled on Eli Landry's skin. She savored its wisdom, but it wasn't to his liking. Hers was the darkest heart. As the cold fire reached out to draw her in, she felt nothing but happiness. After all, she would remain a part of Luke, even if he reigned for all of eternity. It was, by her estimation, a perfect mother's revenge. 34. A cold, low-lying fog was creeping in off the river, chilling the air as it erased the edges of the ominously named End of the World, a stubby, unremarkable peninsula that jutted out into the Industrial Canal and pointed toward Holy Cross. The fog was a natural enough phenomenon, though the timing struck Alice as contrived. She suspected its entrance was a bit of Hollywood Nicholas was employing to make an impression on his khaki-clad acolytes. Alice milled around among Nicholas's new pets, searching for Natalie. She could sense Natalie's presence by using the old trick Luke had taught her, sending out tiny psychic pings that worked a bit like radar, but she had already made two sweeps without spotting her. Alice had the odd feeling that they were circling each other. Natalie's energy seemed off, scattered, almost cloaked, perhaps deflected by the congregant's zeal or affected by her visit with the Boudreaux family. Then again, Alice couldn't get a signal on her phone either, so perhaps Nicholas had placed a magical shield over the site, like the faltering privacy spell woven long ago over Pré-sur-Sang, back when witchcraft didn't have to make accommodations for technology. She undid the ties of her mask and slipped it off, casting a quick glance down at the ornate cat face. The story of the goddess Artemis's pursuit of her brother Lucifer bubbling up as she did. Alice made quick work of pushing the troublesome myth back down into her psyche. She lifted her eyes and scanned the crowd for the others. Fleur and Lucy, Hugo and Wiley. Nothing. She got a hit on Evangeline on the edge of the gathering, and another on Lincoln. They weren't together, but she suspected they were nearby, and the same bit of intuition that told her she and Natalie were circling each other insisted Evangeline and Lincoln were drawing closer to her and each other. She was passing by as one of Nicholas's followers nodded toward the wicker man.
"They can't light that thing up soon enough for me," he said to the woman at his side. "I could do with a little heat."
Alice sensed the two were strangers to each other. The woman, who was stuffed into an undersized extra-large blouse and straining skirt, eyed him with suspicion.
"Or maybe a coat," he said,
his good-natured grin fading in the face of the woman's continued silence. He rubbed his upper arms and rocked up to the balls of his feet and back again, trying to generate warmth. He stopped as he took note of Alice. The woman turned on him, her expression at once irritated and vacuous. "Father didn't offer us coats," she said, sounding offended. "If we were supposed to be wearing coats, Father would have seen to it we had them." She looked earnestly to Alice, seeking a sign of approval for her steadfast faith in Father. "Through him, we shall do great things," she added swiftly, shivering. The blanket justification might have cheered her, but it certainly didn't warm her like a real blanket would.
"Through him, we shall do great things," her nervous companion said quickly, echoing the hollow jingle.
Alice shook her head in disgust and moved on, continuing counterclockwise. Without finding any of the people she had sought, she approached the spot where Art and Polly had positioned themselves to enjoy Nicholas's spectacle, arriving just as two of the younger witches pushed past, lit torches in hand. Alice turned, walking backward a few steps as she watched them move to the center and set light to the wicker man's foundation. A jubilant roar went up from the crowd as the fire began to lick at the wicker man's feet. Alice's eyes followed the flames as they climbed skyward. For a moment, she thought it was only a play of shadow and light, but she witnessed a darkness swooping down from above, followed by a spray of blood that shot out from nothingness. Applause and cheers shook the sight as blood sprayed out from multiple points overhead, invisible clouds bursting open like fireworks. An anguished cry rose up above the den, and a figure writhing in flames broke free of the effigy. It was a man. It was Nicholas. He stumbled forward before falling to the ground. Only then did Alice see the army of hungry shadows, dark, grotesque human silhouettes rising up from beneath the cover of the fog. The majority positioning themselves among Nicholas's followers, but the larger, denser shadows seeming to target the gathered witches. Whatever Nicholas's intentions had been, he had lost control. This gathering had been appropriated by someone with, it appeared, even more diabolic notions. Alice pushed through the oblivious spectators, advancing on Art and Polly.
"Get out of here!" she screamed, trying to make her voice heard over the ovations that were quickly changing into cries of terror. She grasped the hands of a pair of the older witches who'd followed her here, shepherding them toward the twins.
"You have to go!"
she yelled at the resisting, indignant elders. The twins, however, had the sense to move first and ask questions later. They were already gathering those near them into a tight knot.
"Get them out!"
She turned back in time to see two of the shadows circling one of the witches who had lit the effigy. His torch still burned, and he spun around, wielding the torch like a rapier as he advanced and then fell back. His erratic movements told Alice he was attempting to fend off a menace he sensed but couldn't see. The two shadows, for the moment, ignored the boy's attempted parries, focusing their rage on each other.
They circled, their intended prey, swiping at each other with their razor nails, disputing the right of the kill. First one, then the other took notice of her arrival. Together they fell back, bowing to her in obeisance. They saw her as one of them. They saw her as their leader. Alice flashed back to Marceline's claim. She had said Alice was to be their general, their Joan of Arc. "Run," she called to the terrified boy. "Run," she yelled when he didn't move. He cast a quick glance right and left and shot off, dropping his torch. She hoped he'd get enough of a head start before he attracted another of the shadows with his flight. A movement at the center of the disintegrating effigy caught her attention. The fire was running out of fuel, but the flames rose higher instead of dying, no longer giving off light as much as devouring the light around them. Their once intense heat had turned in a heartbeat to a glacial cold. Another figure, this one undeterred and untouched by the flames, emerged from the conflagration. She understood in a flash of insight that the pyre served as a portal, a doorway between the common world and a place of nightmare. Alice caught a glimpse of the creature from behind, a kind of chimera, part human, part beast, but she didn't have time to process it, let alone consider what it might mean. Shadows were advancing on her, bringing with them tributes. She looked up in horror as they piled the heads of their victims at her feet. There, the woman who had gloried in being cold. There, the man who had dared to want a coat. And dozens more. In the distance, beyond the fire, she saw Natalie. Natalie was trying to stand, but could only seem to make it to her knees before tumbling back over. Three of the shadows were advancing on her. Leader, General, Joan of Arc, fire. In that moment, Alice saw her purpose with absolute clarity. She was to lead this army, to lead them away from those she loved, to lead them out of the common world, to a hell from which they could never return. She, like Joan of Arc, was destined to burn. Alice threw back her head and called out to them with all the pain, all the rage, all the fear she held inside her. The shadows stopped. They listened. And then they obeyed, falling into formation and following lockstep behind her as she began to lead them into the dark, icy flames. The center of the fire seemed an impossible distance away, but as she gained on it, she saw the common world had folded itself back around the fire. The edges hovered, shimmering like summer heat on asphalt. At last, she reached the event horizon, where one world ended and the other begun. She held up a hand to signal her army to stop. Then she paused at the edge to take one last breath. 35. Evangeline was alone on this path. Reverend Bill was gone. But she felt the dark man all around her. Her feet were bare, but it didn't matter. They didn't actually touch the ground. The earth below her had grown thin enough to be translucent, and beneath the asphalt and soil, below the roots of ghost trees, Evangeline could see a darkness writhing like a snake, wriggling back and forth in precise straight lines. A new gospel, a revelation waiting to be made manifest. A pair of witches touched their torches to the dry brush at the base of the wicker man, and flames began to rise. As above, so below. The fire at the feet of the effigy was at the same time the spark of the dark man, burning its way into the common world. No, burning away the illusion of separateness. Evangeline now saw the two worlds as one, not layered atop each other, but each existing at once, like the two true natures of the necklace. A congregation stood between her and the fire. In the one reality, those gathered were the remnants of the pale souls who had danced through the heart of the fire in search of oblivion. In the other, they were her former lovers, sad acolytes, who, gathered together by the riverside in their matching modest dress, resembled her former father's church group awaiting baptism. Hungry shadows, the broken witches of the Dreaming Road, moved in silence among these fanciful, faithful congregants. The shadows, mirrors, the desperate witches of the common world, basked in the glow of the congregants' adoration. Men, visible to none save themselves and Evangeline, played soldier like little boys among them. They moved with impunity among the others, confident they were the hunters. They failed to consider the hungry shadows' heightened sense of smell. The shadows fell on them first. It was an astounding sight to see thin air burst into a shower of blood. A roar rose up from the crowd, cheers and wild applause celebrating the bloody deaths. Some of the witches clearly perceived the bursts of blood as part of Nicholas's longest night pageantry. Others, perhaps, thought it a sacrifice. The acolytes, she intuited, considered it a baptism, and those covered in splatter were treated with the special awe reserved for the lucky chosen. Only one toy soldier had the time to cry out before a shadow snatched him up. And like a bird returning to the nest to feed its young, it carried the screaming man to its companions before quartering him with claws and fangs. Evangeline spotted Natalie, rising to her feet, turning a full circle, falling back to her knees. A terrified, anguished animal cry came from the man concealed in the center of the pyre. Nicholas had planned to make a triumphant entry, bursting forth unharmed from the inferno, but the dark man had a vision of his own. Nicholas stumbled, burning, from the conflagration, falling and rising before he somehow, perhaps on instinct, found the water's edge. In a final, desperate act, he tumbled forward into the flow and disappeared beneath its surface. The hungry shadows fell next on Nicholas's followers, the sheep who'd agreed to sacrifice all for certainty. In the end, the dark man had honored the deal these poor fools had struck with Nicholas. They could hope for no purer form of certainty in their lives than having those lives snuffed out. No greater clarity than annihilation. On the edge of the gathering, Evangeline spotted Alice trying to guide a knot of confused geriatric witches away from the slaughter. A couple Evangeline didn't recognize joined her. Alice must have deputized them to take over the rescue, for she stopped and turned back, walking in a straight line directly toward the fire. As the last of the sacrifices, his fingers clawing the earth, was jerked upward into oblivion, another creature strode into the common world. The head and cloven-footed legs of a goat, the breasts of a woman, the sex of a man. Man joined with beast, female joined with male. The beast awaited her at the altar, this side of madness. Evangeline recognized the essence at the core of the horrifying chimera. It was Luke, returned to her in the form of the beast. Luke had passed through the gates of madness, through the gates of oblivion, to touch the source of all magic, the realm where nothing was but all was possible. In his kiss, he carried the last breath of the old magic, and with that breath in her lungs, Evangeline could determine the fate of magic in the common world, if it would return or fade away forever. The discordant drone of an ancient flute accompanied the timeless drumming of her father's heart to create her wedding march. There was no question of love. Had Luke ever loved her, he would not have conspired to bring her to this moment. No, he loved the queen and had willingly become a monster so he could claim her for himself and through union with her become king. A beast is never reformed. A beast will forever remain a beast. Evangeline joined him before the burning wicker man, the collection of twigs and branches and hemp that would act as officiant to the sacred union of the Queen of Heaven and the King of Bones and Ashes. The vows the dark man commanded them to repeat echoed the screams of those sacrificed to bring the king into the common world. A voice called her name from another reality, from a few yards away. Lincoln called to her once more. He was speaking to her, or trying to. The words held little meaning in themselves, but they caused memories from her subconscious to surface, much like the images Sugar used to communicate with her. The day the electricity between the two of them had burned out the lights. The night she had almost ripped him apart with beak and claw. The comfort they found in each other and how it had healed them both. Flames glinted off the sword in his hand. He'd come to stop her, just as she had asked of him. Perhaps he believed he had found the courage to end her, but the look on his face was evidence enough he hadn't. He started a slow approach toward her, not like he was afraid of her, but like he feared she would take flight. "I know who you are." The beast snorted and fumed, but didn't move on Lincoln as she'd expected he would. Evangeline felt herself surfacing from beneath the haze that had enveloped her. "I choose you." She heard Lincoln speak these words rather than merely feeling their impression. He held the sword out to her, hilt first, offering it to her. She took it from him, felt its heft lifting it, and listening to the sounds its sharp blade made as it cut through the air. She could feel the beast tensing, growing excited in the anticipation of watching the death of an unworthy rival.
"You can't change your parents," Lincoln said. "And you sure can't change your past."
He knelt before her.
"But you could choose your partner, and you can choose your path."
He lifted his head and looked straight into the heart of the dark fire before him. He didn't flinch.
"Now, choose me or end me, but don't make me have to watch you give up on yourself."
Holding the hilt with both hands, she drew the sword back and swung it slowly forward until the edge of its blade pressed against Lincoln's neck. She sensed Luke quivering in anticipation, mentally urging her to sever Lincoln's head from his shoulders. He delighted in imagining the headless corpse falling forward at his cloven feet. It would be Evangeline's gift to him.
"I'm sorry," she said, addressing Lincoln. "I truly am."
She pulled the sword up and lunged, driving the tip of the blade through the beast's heart. Luke stumbled backward, the goat lips opening to cry out, but no sound came, only a tiny puff of air. Evangeline could sense it coming toward her as the fire fell to darkness, forming a suctioning gravity that caught hold of the body of the beast and pulled it back, wresting it from the common world. She reached down to grasp Lincoln's hand, to steady him as he rose on his shaking knees. But then the same irresistible force gripped her and tugged her back too. Lincoln dove to grab her. Evangeline knew he couldn't save her, that the gravity that had claimed her was too strong. He would end up sacrificing himself for nothing.
She bent his fingers back, trying to break his grasp on her.
You have to let go of me. You have to let go.
She watched as the reality of the unreal situation dawned on him. His jaw stiffened, and he tightened his hold on her.
Get it through your head, girl, he said. I choose you.
He rushed forward, wrapping his arms around her as the common world faded away. The last glimpse Evangeline had of the common world was of Alice as the final breath of magic claimed her. Of course, Evangeline realized. That was how it had always been meant to be. She tasted a bittersweet revelation, an epiphany Alice too would soon share. One person's strength is another's madness. Evangeline couldn't have survived the knowing, but her last wish was that Alice might. After all, out of all the witches of New Orleans, Alice had always been the strongest. In the final moment before Evangeline returned to the eternal fire where nothing is, but all is possible, two seemingly conflicting thoughts came to her, not as opposing ideas, but as polarities of a single truth. There is no such thing as magic. All that there is made of magic. 36. Burning ice, not a gasp, an invasion. Alice's lungs expanded, though she felt like they might crumble to icy dust on exhale. When the breath escaped her, it came out as the spicy, bitter perfume of myrrh. She heard Uncle Vincent's anxious voice calling her name.
Alice!
The sound of it felt like a punch in the gut.
What are you doing over there?
Alice realized she stood at the edge of Nicholas's yard. A wall of swirling water slid before her eyes, its undulating surface scintillating in the brilliant light of an impossible white sun. This was the day everything had changed. The day she had first encountered Babu Jean.
You know it isn't safe out here, Vincent pressed. Come back inside.
She couldn't answer. She couldn't take a step. All she could do was turn her head to look back at him over her shoulder. Vincent wasn't there. He had been too good for this world, she realized, too kind. She sent out a wish he had found a heaven with cold beer, old dogs, and an endless supply of beat-up cars to refurbish. Like Alice herself, her uncle had always been a loner. She hoped he wasn't still alone. Above her, the cerulean sky slid into hematite, then went full black, the diamond sun blinking out, dying as if poisoned by the sky. A heart-rending cry went up around Alice, giving her the sense that all souls, living and dead, and all objects, animate and inanimate, mourned as one. All except Alice herself, who, alone in her wonder, could find no tears. The cool silver-blue points of seven stars pierced the blackness above her. A creaking caught her attention, and she turned her face toward its source. The door to her father's house eased open, and a cold silver light, like that of the seven stars hanging above, spilled out of it. She felt something brush up against her leg, and she startled. A purring patch of gray fur wove around her ankles. Glowing, viridescent eyes looked up at her. Sugar padded past her, then slunk back into the blinding whiteness. A figure, a dark silhouette, appeared in the doorway, then stepped forward. Alice recognized Daniel in an instant, even though his form was in flux, flashing back and forth between her beloved nanny and her earliest nightmare, Babu Jean. He turned. They turned,
and went back into the light. Alice sensed the answer to every question she had ever posed lay beyond the threshold, and that realization, tantalizing and terrifying in equal measure, held her in place. She felt a pressure build around her, as if the air itself was congealing. The horizon tightened, and the seven stars seemed to be descending, falling to the earth in slow motion, though Nicholas's house, the house of her earliest memories, remained unchanged. Alice realized the world beyond the house was shrinking, leaving her without a choice. This was not a new experience for her. She'd endured a similar constriction of her reality before, on the Dreaming Road. But this was not the Dreaming Road. This was, as far as she could tell, the common world. The world she had always held to be objective reality. She trod along the walk toward the house, an unseeable force sweeping her along like a gust of wind chasing fallen leaves. Alice arrived at the doorway. She could feel the force willing her forward, but she hesitated, uncertain. The light spilling through the opening obscured what lay inside. She didn't know how long she stood there, straddling what felt like two separate worlds, but not because she lost track of time. It felt more like time stood still, waiting for her as she gathered her nerve. She didn't remember taking the step across the threshold, but found herself on the other side as soon as she made the choice to cross. Beyond the threshold, she had expected to find a world of wonder, or perhaps a world of terrors. But the only thing to shock her was the banality of what she found awaiting her. She stood in the hall of Nicholas's house. His office sat, as it always had, off to the left, and the staircase lay dead ahead.
"I'm sorry, love."
Daniel's lilting voice came from the foot of the stairs, accompanied by the shing-shing sound of Babu Jean's grating razor teeth.
"I didn't know about any of this."
He motioned with Jean's sharp nails from the death mask face down the gangly frame.
"Not until I came to free you from the Dreaming Road, and found myself stuck there instead."
"I think," Alice said as she approached him, "I did. That's why the connection Jean and I have felt so familiar." She took his hand, not fearing the nails, and in that instant, the monster shimmered and turned back into Daniel. "You and Babu Jean, you aren't the same."
"No, not the same, but not separate either. Two expressions of the same energy, much like the relationship between Papa Legba and the Dark Man. There is no dichotomy, only polarity."
He touched her cheek, then tapped the tip of her nose.
"It's time, love," he said with a nervous smile. "Shall we?"
She saw hope in his eyes, hope clouded by uncertainty. He was unsure, she realized, of her. Not of her nature, but of her strength. Alice nodded, and he began to lead her up the steps. Halfway up the staircase, he disappeared, and then reappeared on the landing. He smiled down at Alice, unaware he had switched back to the appearance of a monster. It didn't matter. Alice understood the truth. If one could think in such terms, of the person she loved lay somewhere between the two extremes. She mounted the final stairs, counting the moments until an incandescence, a deep rumble. There it was, the flash of lightning she'd been expecting. "What is this place?"
"You know what it is, love. It's Nicholas's house. Your first home."
Yes, it was that, but it was something more. "What is this place?" she insisted. Daniel breathed out the patient, impatient sigh he'd once reserved for muddy tracks across the kitchen floor.
It's the resolution.
The resolution?
The point where dissonance is resolved. In short, it's the end of the world.
A shimmer, and Babu Jean was gone. Daniel once again stood before her.
Lisette, Evangeline, and you. It could have been any one of you. But you're special. Always have been. Everything that has ever happened to you has been to strengthen you, to temper you, to prepare you for this moment.
What are we doing here, Daniel?
Lisette is so strong, he continued, paying no heed to her question. She would suffer any fate, death or even worse for herself, as long as her children and grandchildren were left untouched. That's why she couldn't be the one. The one to decide can't have children, at least not ones she loves. Lisette failed her test, or passed it, depending on your perspective. Either way, she proved herself not to be the one. Mrs. Perrault, she has all the strength in the world, but not the right kind for this crucible.
You wouldn't have turned against your children either, Alice said. Daniel loved the mess that was her brother Hugo. There was no denying that. Alice knew he loved her too. His totality loved her. Even his nightmare ego of Babu Jean. And Daniel also loved Luke. Even now, she knew if any possibility of redemption existed for her big brother, Daniel would lead him to it, by the nose if need be. Daniel may have had nothing to do with their conception, but they were his children. A tear escaped his eye.
Enough of that, young lady. He wiped the tear away. Of course, I was never to be the one.
The one to what?
Evangeline. She too was strong. And unlike Lisette, she wasn't bound by the love of a child. But she wasn't as strong as you, my love. Alice remembered the ringing of Evangeline's laughter. Such a sweet, generous creature, such a loving woman. She would have been a fine choice, except that she would have crumbled under the weight of the knowing. Still, she isn't really gone. She never will be, regardless of what we do here. She's a part of magic now.
Daniel paused for a moment, letting his words linger, then said, I think in my heart I always expected that it would come down to the two of us in the end. A loud meow from below, as sugar snaked through his legs. He stooped and scooped her up into his arms.
Yes, of course, the three of us. I stand corrected.
He scratched behind Sugar's ears and set her on the ground. Sugar circled around and stared up at Alice. Without words, Alice somehow understood the feline too, felt something akin to pride in her. Daniel reached out to her. Behind him was the large landing window. Alice imagined she could see herself, a small girl on tiptoes, peering through it at the maelstrom below. This, she realized, was the image, the inspiration that had given birth to her. She joined Daniel before the window and took his hand. Together, they turned to face the dim gray light filtering in through the panes. Beyond the glass, the dirty waters of Katrina still swirled. A white plastic lawn chair bobbed up and down, then rushed out of view. A blue tricycle followed, triggering a flash of its owner's face, a younger boy she had pushed along on the trike. A plastic pink flamingo, a red door. Alice took inventory of the expected objects, ticking them off on the mental checklist she had long carried with her, cached away as if in anticipation of this very moment. A bubble of trapped air rose up through the muddy water, surfacing a kaleidoscope of bright colors Alice remembered as belonging to the covers of a collection of DVDs and paperback books. The colors rotated once, twice, then began to sink once again into the deluge. Beneath the colors, no, through the colors, through the water itself, she could make out symbols. Only then did she discern the pattern buried beneath what she'd perceived as a random collection of flotsam. These symbols were the sigils from the hospital in Sinclair Isle. Then the sigils melded together to become the image she had traced on her window on the Dreaming Road. The image shattered, though Alice could see each splinter still contained the image of the whole. Her mind turned to the Veves, the living symbols in the windows of Lisette Perrault's shop. Yes, they too contained a hidden depth only hinted at by the visible. All were two-dimensional expressions of a deeper reality. Alice clutched Daniel's hand tighter. One book remained afloat, its waterlogged spine giving way, its individual pages coming loose from the binding. The pages rippled on the surface of the maelstrom, their words floating up and separating from the sodden paper, unwinding themselves from the page. "When is a book not a book?" Daniel said. As he spoke, his words appeared on the surface of the water. She tried to close her eyes, but Daniel pulled her to him.
"You can't look away, love. You can never again not see this. The gates have opened."
He kissed her cheek.
"The angels have fallen, and you've been chosen as the sacrifice."
She opened her mouth to speak, to protest, her own words lining up on the pages before her, disappearing as she changed her mind. Her memories, for the moment sharp, shocked her by disintegrating, by changing. Words she had spoken or intended to speak came instead from the mouths of others, and their words became hers. Alternate timelines, positing infinite possibilities, collapsed into the experience she had known. Alice began to see the world through others' eyes. She remembered crossing through Jackson Square, a brightly colored tourist map in hand, as surely as if she herself were Lisette Perrault. She saw a different symbol, one she knew through Lisette to be Papa Legba's veve. She registered Lisette's epiphany as if it had been her own. The square, Legba's veve. The one was a model of the other.
"The square," Alice heard Daniel whisper, "could be understood as a three-dimensional representation of the two-dimensional design, yes? Magic has long been preparing us for a truth science is only just beginning to explore. Quantum theory and the theory of gravity are finally beginning to approach the concept of a holographic reality, a truth those who know magic have long sensed." In a flash, it struck her. Two-dimensional symbols strung together to create a three-dimensional experience. Editorial conflagrations erasing earlier efforts, reworking of plots, characters coming to the page, then disappearing, deleted, as if they had never existed. The importance of the written word to her own existence. The Book of the Unwinding wasn't some musty tome moldering in a locked chest in a convent's attic, nor was it only a single spark capable of burrowing into a person's soul. Alice now stood in the heart of madness. Only there could the book's true nature be perceived. The world fell flat into a string of characters against a blank surface. Force and restraint in balance. "We are the Book of the Unwinding." "The story is what matters, love," Daniel said.
There is no greater power than story. The story is all there is. It is our reality, and beyond it, nothingness. In the face of the madness, an epiphany struck her, and Alice began laughing.
Storyville, she said. You were trying to tell me all along.
Daniel nodded. I think so. At least the part of me, the piece of Babu Jean, who did understand. In retrospect, it seems a fairly heavy-handed clue. Daniel waved a hand before the symbols, which shimmered and changed shape, taking on depth and texture, and again Alice was looking at what she understood to be real.
It takes a special type of person to learn she doesn't exist, then go on living. You've been groomed all your life to stand firm in the face of madness. It's up to you, love. This can all end now, here. You can stop all suffering, end all joy. You can simply erase us all, everything and everyone you've ever known. Plunge us back into the nothingness from which we sprang. No more Nicholas, no more Celestin, no more hospital on Sinclair. But then, there'd also be no more Hugo, no more Natalie, no more me, no more you.
He paused, raising an eyebrow and looking down his nose at her. The expression she remembered him making when she was small and he was cutting her a deal such as, take your nap now and you can go to the park this afternoon. Or, finish the spinach and you can have ice cream. Somehow, in the face of this madness, discussing his own non-existence, he was still himself. He was still Daniel. Or, you'll find the beauty, the value of creation, a speck of meaning in an endless sea of absurdity. But you'd have to be strong to let our reality continue, aware that it doesn't exist, aware that you don't exist, at least not in the concrete way you once believed. To accept what has come before, what has been written, so to speak, as fixed, immutable. And that what is to come will spring from the interaction of innumerable variables, of which the will of Alice Marin is but a single factor. Daniel paused, like he wanted to give this last bit a chance to fully sink in, pulling a serious face, another familiar expression, this the one he used whenever she would refuse to pick up her toys or brush her teeth. It meant it was time to put on her big girl pants and get on with it. There have been others, he continued, before you who have stood where you stand now, who have had to make the choice you now must make. Alice didn't have to ask. It was self-evident those who came before had chosen to continue the illusion. They had chosen yes. Of course, it would be just the three, he corrected himself, of us, who'd share the secret. She felt sugar brush up against her leg, twining around it. Anyone else you share the truth with would think you've gone mad, that you've lost your grip on reality. And in a way, they'd be right. But you'll always have us to share the burden. Daniel reached out with both hands to take hers, then smiled down at her. So, my love, he said, grasping her hands tightly, ready to plunge with her into the abyss if that was what she asked of him. What will it be? She took in his mop of curly red hair, his crooked, perfectly imperfect smile, his sparkling green eyes. They were Toth's emerald tablets. They were the jewels of Indra's net. 37. A sudden flash, like heat lightning, followed by a low rumbling. Lisette associated it with distant thunder, even though it was less a sound than a vibration she felt deep in her bones. When the rumble died, it gave way to an almost reverential silence,
or maybe more of a quiet dread. This was the moment of final judgment. A nauseating vertigo gave way to a sweet resin scent, like the frankincense and myrrh of the incense burned at Mass. A blessing, then, rather than a curse. If Lisette mentioned any of this to the nurses passing back and forth before the open door of Manon's room, she'd find herself being threaded through the hole of a CT scanner in zero time flat. But these weren't symptoms of a second stroke. These meager manifestations, along with a feeling deep down in Lisette's gut, counted as the only signs that the world had just been made anew. She glanced over at her beautiful daughter, sleeping peaceful, unaware, then turned back to the window. The darkness outside produced a reflection of her own features, and behind her face, that of the old man, Papa Legba. Lisette's father had sworn that her Legba wasn't the Legba. But Lisette had just held Papa's hand as she watched the world be reborn. She knew now that the truth was a tricky beast to pin down. Her manifestation of Legba was different than her mother's, but he, too, was the Legba, at least for now. She sharpened her focus and looked beyond herself, through Papa Legba, to take in a sliver of the night sky. The seven stars of the Big Dipper hung low on the horizon, but shone bright enough to be seen through the big city glare. But they, too, had changed. She no longer saw them as the seven gates or as the seven wounds of the god. They were, at least to her mind, a family. Her family. She selected a star for Remy, a star for Manon, one star for each of her parents, one for her beloved Isidore, and one for herself. She saved the brightest of all of them for Joy. Around their constellation, other stars gained in brightness, and she knew them for the ancestors who came before, and the children who would come after. Lisette felt a hand touch her own and looked over to find Isidore squatting before her.
"I think maybe you should go home," he whispered. "Get some rest. Remy's waiting for you downstairs."
He patted her hand.
"Come on now. I got this."
Lisette looked at her husband, and in that moment, her heart felt so full of love for him, so proud of the life they had built together. She began to cry. His brow scrunched up with worry.
"Is everything okay?"
She lifted his hand to her lips and kissed it.
"Yes, you sweet man. Everything is okay."
She touched his hand to her cheek.
"For the first time in one hell of a long one."
December 22. 38. Natalie came too, standing across from Bonne Nouvelle, her eyes fixed on a mass of flowers and candles that spilled from the sidewalk in front of the club out into the street. She blinked and scanned the faces of the people milling about in the neon-lit night. Some passed by, slowing and bending to add to the collection. Others watched on, acting almost hypnotized by the bright white beam illuminating a familiar-looking stranger in the street, in front of the sea of tributes. A man pointed a video camera at her as she pressed a hand to her ear, seeming to be mid-conversation with someone not there. Natalie's eyes drifted to a van that sat a bit farther down the street. She read the words, "Five Alive," printed in a large italic font on its side. Of course, Five Alive. The woman standing before the camera was Katie Cunningham, the same reporter who had reported on Frank DeMagnan's dollhouse. Natalie couldn't join the pieces together. Flowers and candles and Katie speaking to the camera, her manner animated, yet reverent.
She was my friend, a woman with 86 proof breath said into Natalie's